are just 22 years old, approximately this time of year, 22 years ago, we decided to start a business. At that time, we were working at MIT in the computer laboratory, where we had developed a large computer for air defense. The computer then had many of the characteristics of a modern mini computer. In fact, there's a sales brochure written on it that sounds just like one today. It even had 16-bit word length. It had cathode ray tube with light pen and joystick, had interactive typewriters. The one difference was size. It was in a room approximately twice as big as this room. Racks were 11 feet high, 26 inches wide, and the room was filled with them. The console was a room the size of this part here, with panels on all sides, and the cables coming into it came like a waterfall into the room. And it was in that environment that we learned a few characteristics of computers that were different from the rest of the world. At that time, computers were very expensive. They were held in awe. Most of them were developed by professors. Professors always have to make something elegant, awesome, in order to have something over their students. And companies that had them put them behind glass so they could show off and keep everybody away from them. At MIT, the computers were, during the day, worked on for air defense, and at night anybody could play with them. And we learned three things from MIT. We also had technology, which was somewhat unique, because we knew how to make fast computers inexpensively with transistors. But the main things we learned at MIT were that computers were fun, that computers can be interactive and helpful to people, the computers then being used, and still in many places being used, the information is put down on paper, is then typed by a clerk in a form that will be put in the computer. Long time later on, the answer comes back, and it may be filled with mistakes, or no one trusts it, or it's too late to care, and it is all dull and uninteresting. With interactive computing, when the person types, he can immediately see results, and it helps, and the feedback makes the job interesting. The view of these things is what motivated us to start a company. We saw the need for inexpensive, fast computers that would be interactive and readily available to do jobs. The other aspect, the third thing, was that computers could interact with machinery, and the air defense system would interact with radar and airplanes, and we did not do just arithmetic. First thing we did was go to a risk capital company in Boston called American Research and Development Corporation, and we told them we wanted to start a computer company. They were not very interested because it was crazy at that time to propose a small company to make computers when they cost $3 million each, and no one was making money. Fortune magazine said no one was about to. But they were fascinated. And after much consideration, they gave us money. Oh, the story we tell about our meeting with them, they said, we'll let you see the board of directors and make the proposal. So we got ready, and they gave us three suggestions. One was, don't use the word computers because that won't sell. Another one was, 5% profit wasn't enough for a risk organization, so we promised 10%. And then they said, promised fast results because most of the board is over 80. So we promised to make profit here. They gave us $70,000 capital. So 22 years ago, with $70,000, we started the corporation. The nice thing about $70,000 is you could watch every one of them. They're so cool. And we were profitable the first year. And the other nice thing about raising money that way, none of it was our money. We got $70,000 for them. And there was a clear understanding that with their money, which current bankrupt insurance companies and individuals and banks, they expected us to return a profit. And so that understanding was very simple. 22 years ago in this country, profit was a bad word. Forget that now. The war wasn't very long over. Still many people were on the verge of being communist, and profit was a bad word. We, however, had a clear understanding that we were making profit. And throughout our whole company, perhaps in a very unique way, ever since then, almost all the people understand the importance of profit. In a month or a quarter, when we haven't shipped all we were supposed to, people work very hard to get material out because they know that in order to continue to grow, we have to have a consistent profit. So through these 22 years, our profit has been very consistent, and we have a whole organization that works hard to maintain it that way. The idea that a computer can be fun and exciting and interesting, we can tell you many stories. One story, we donated a computer to the educational part of MIT. It was on the second floor of a building above the IBM computer. The IBM computer was the main computer for MIT. It was literally behind two walls of glass, and people would bring their problem in one day on IBM cards, put it in a slot. The next day, they would get their answer back, and it usually said, you made a mistake. The floor above, where the students were using our computers, they could use it, they could sign up for it and use it 24 hours a day with no supervision. The room was open. They could sit down and use it. They just had to sign up in the empty space ahead of time. In that time, students got involved with the computer. They sit and type at it. And if you walk by, it would sometimes seem strange because they type, somebody would come back and they would laugh. People would gather around and you look at what they're reading and it was nothing. But out of that group came much of the understanding of what computers will do. And it really was a big step in the dream which we had, which was that computers are fun, they'll interact with people, make jobs interesting, and will also interact with controlling equipment. Another story. I borrowed a terminal from the company, and it's in my home. I have not gotten to use it yet. I have a son who's going to MIT who spends full time studying computers, and you think he would be sick and tired of computers. He was home for Saturday, was going to go back to school because he had a lot of studying to do. Saturday night, he found the terminal in my study. He dialed in the telephone and found the game on the computer, a digital computer. And from there, he was playing the game. He played that late Saturday night, all day Sunday, and I don't know when he went back to school. The interactive nature of a computer, the fun you can have with it, making your own program, or playing someone else's game, it just grasps people's imagination. People fall in love with computers. Now, when the machines we donated to MIT were being used, it so captured the students' imagination that some of them stopped studying, some stopped washing, some stopped eating, and the administration almost closed down the room. But computers do that to people. Computers grab their imaginations, and it makes dull jobs interesting. And this has been the vision we've had as a company. Now, we do the jobs which IBM leaves behind. IBM does those large number of relatively easy jobs, and many people have the same application. We serve that most of that large part which they leave behind, which means that the number of applications we have are enormous. We spend a big part of our development funds, we spend approximately 8% of our income on research and development, and most of that we spend in software. Because we spend the software to be used on that multitude of applications, none of it is detailed. It's not as detailed as IBM does on a small number of applications. but the software is a major part of our investment. Our hardware development is a very conservative type development because we have many users who are dependent on the previous units they bought. So we always have to take account of our previous customers. But every time we make a new machine, we make them on approximately 2-year cycles in any one category, we try to do something dramatic and exciting in hardware development. A major part of our organization is our service. We have 9,000 service people in the field who service our equipment. This is a tremendous advantage because to most people, service is a key part of the problem. They want equipment, they want very useful equipment that will be efficient, but above all, they want service when they need it. We also have 1,500 software support people who will help with the software. We have a large number of customers who want to do many of the activities themselves. The nature of many of our customers is that they want to sometimes do the maintenance, often want to do the applications. So we have a very extensive training organization. We train both customers and our people inside. So we have 900 instructors. We teach 6 or 8 hours a day. And they're spread around the world. Most of them are right here, but in each of the countries of the world, there are instructors in classrooms, and the total is 900. So it's a major part of our service to our customers and preparing our own people. We tend to be careful and conservative in many ways. We have been growing for quite a few years between 30 and 50% a year. And in this area, we've been quite bold. On the other hand, we try to have the money we need before we grow. We can be quite bold, but we maintain cash usually before we grow. This last year, I think we grew just 30%, some better 30%. We thought we might grow quite a bit more, so we raised $250 million. And $250 million is sitting there because growing 30%, we didn't need it, and actually that cash grew. So we raised the money before we had a big growth, and in the future, it seems that we can maintain, without raising capital, growth of 20 to 25%, and when we need go more than that, we will need outside capital. The growth rate in some businesses seems large. Turns out that with the enthusiasm of the type of people we have, maintaining a level of 25 to 30% is makes many of our people impatient. Even 40 and 50% that we have had in the past, people often thought was much too slow. The future of computers we are more enthusiastic about than ever. The fact that computers are used all over, the young people have learned to use them, they make so many jobs that have been dull, exciting, and the prices are going down, the availability is becoming so much more ready to everyone, and the applications that people are thinking of are just starting. So we're very enthusiastic about the future, and we are more excited than ever about the place computers have in the future. So with that, I'll close and let you ask me any questions you'd like to ask. Anything at all? Yes?
With the reduction in the cost of turning to him and so on and so forth, your value added, presumably, on hardware is going down the whole time. And
Well, there's two parts to that question, two parts of the answer to the question. First of all, when we say the price is going down, we say the price per unit of computation and the price per unit of memory. And they've gone down dramatically. At the same time, people's tastes or their needs have gone in the other direction. And the average computer we sell has stayed about the same. People spend about the same for memory, but get 10, 20 times as much. And they get much more useful computers, but the price stays the same. So the nature of our business hasn't changed significantly. The other part, however, is that by tradition, started by IBM, we have not charged sufficiently for software. At first, people thought you write the software once, then reproducing it costs almost nothing, and so you give it for free. In fact, when we started the company, when you bought a computer from us, we gave you all the future software free. At that time, we charged very dearly for the hardware and the software we didn't have a handle on. Now, this distorted the pricing of computers. We and IBM and others would then subsidize the free software by raising the price on our peripherals, our memories, and our central processors, so that people coming in could sell central processors, memories, and peripherals for a less price, and they'd expect just to get software from us, which of course is nonsense. So 2 years ago or so, we started charging for that software. Many people thought this was wrong because they were used to having it free. A few months ago, IBM very boldly changed all the pricing in the industry and charged very dearly for the software. We suspect that they will charge significantly more than it appears even today. And what this means is that everyone will have to compete fairly on the same basis, and we will slowly evolve into following IBM because it's the obvious way to price, where you charge according to what it costs you. And so in the long run, it won't make much difference how things go because we'll be charging according to our costs. Yes?
I understand you moved into a management structure last year. Why did you do that?
Oh.
How long do you think?
We did not make any drastic change. I can tell you what we did. We have for many years broken the company into product lines. We have about 25 product lines, although sometimes you use different numbers because we group them in various ways. Each one is run as if it's a separate business. We, for our size company, maintain many different markets and areas because they're each broken, more than most companies can, because they're broken into individual businesses. Each one makes their own decisions, their budgets, their planning, and in often cases, their software. And each one is run like it was a business. And we run the company as a sum of those. We have relatively little overall planning or marketing. It's done by the experts in each field. Now, we grouped them. We had them in three groups, and then a year ago we regrouped them a little more logically. And so there's no major change, we just changed the groupings. The significant change was that we put all the commercial product lines in one, so that they can work together better as a common problem. And all our technical and scientific in another one, and the third one contains everything else. Now, the other change was that because the company is a grouping of 23 or so separate businesses, my office had very little staff. It was just my secretary and I. Sometimes I had an assistant, sometimes I didn't. But even though we were set up that way, I needed more staff. So we picked three of the top people of the company to be my staff, which have three openings. And by the time you fill the three openings and fill those, we reorganize these three new groups. So there's really no great significance to it. It's just that it helps, it's good, it's logical. Things are easier, things are better. And people have a fresh look at things. But there's no great theoretical change in organization. Another question?
Could you please comment on your dividend policy?
Oh, our dividend policy is very easy.
I know.
When we grow faster than we can finance, there's a number somewhere between 20 and 25% that we can self-finance. If we grow more than that, we need outside capital. If we grow less than that, we make capital. So when we're growing faster than that, and up until now we have been growing 30 to 40%, we've been raising large amounts of money. And it isn't logical to go out and sell stock or sell bonds and then give part of that in dividends. It's not very logical. However, as we get bigger, we can't grow 50% and 40 or maybe 30. So when we get closer to that point, then we have dividends. We believe in dividends. Dividends are the reason people invest in the company. And for a period of time now, we are increasing our cash position. If we see in the future where it will increase, or someday we expect to increase, then we will plan to do that. Just not logical as yet. Yes? But the orders in the first quarter? Because we are many product lines, it's a little more complicated to say in detail. But right now, in the last period of time, the demand has been high for computers. Right now, we are limited in most areas by delivery, by what we plan to do. We are big enough now that we cannot manufacture much more than what we planned to do 6 months or a year ago. So for this period of time, our limitation is what we planned to do 6 months or a year ago. Now, we are very concerned about what might happen in the immediate future to the economy. Today, we see no limitations in the orders of computers. Computers are very easy to sell, the demand is high, and we could sell more if we had planned on selling more earlier. We didn't plan to sell more because we were concerned about the economy. If there is no slowdown in the economy, we will be embarrassed that we didn't make a lot more. If there is a slowdown and we made a lot more, we would be less than we would be catastrophe. So we like to be careful. Right now, we're in the enjoyable situation of having more orders available to us than we can deliver, which makes us feel very safe in the immediate future if the economy does slow down. And we're still growing, but very significantly is compared to most companies. Yes?
There is a point when you expect to say that the growth of the company will be at somewhat slower pace than it has been over the last 10 years or so. How far out do you think this down to a lower rate of growth is?
The slowdown to IBM has grown 12 to 18% for quite a few years. That can happen, that comes with size. Two or three years ago, we figured that, I guess when we were 18 years old, we figured that if we continued the same growth rate for the next 18 years, the company would have the population of France and the gross national product significantly bigger. We just can't keep that growth rate going, obviously. So someday, we'll have to slow down to IBM's growth rate. Now, I won't give you a prediction because when we sit looking in the future, we say it has to slow down fairly soon. But as we get closer, we see the products we have a facility, and we always say, one more year, and we won't, and then we'll slow down. So, we probably, we don't know, and it's better not to say, because the demand is still there for our kind of computers. We feel, we introduced this kind of computing, interactive, distributed processing, and now that IBM and the others are there too, it increases the demand rather than cuts into the demand. So, with that enthusiasm and that demand, we won't slow down to 12 to 18% for a while. But when we get there, we'll be making a lot of cash too, and giving you dividends. Yes? I can't quite hear you. Truly mundane applications, you will never notice there's a computer there. Soon, there'll be at least one complete, real computer in every car, maybe two or three. Because they're so mundane, you will never know they're there, and the service problem will be less than with your automobile today. So, in the extreme, the truly mundane application is not a problem. Now, most of those will not be sold by us. They'll be $5 each. And now, the microwave oven sold by Amana has a real computer in it. The use is very mundane. Most of us will have a computer in our thermostat in our home. We need it. It's important. Those are mundane, and there's no service problem. The applications of, when you really do computing, the service then gets to be in those items like a typewriter that types all day long, many characters, who just need certain maintenance, as far as we can see now. And if it's like running a thermostat with no moving parts, it would need no service. So the things which need a service are things like typewriters. Almost any area of industry, education, science, the number of applications are just enormous. We're now doing word processing. We've almost filled our company up with word processors. Their usefulness to secretaries is so high that if we try to remove them now, I think we have a rebellion on our hands. Just the need filling up industry with word processors is just an enormous market. Electronic mail, we now have a company, Electronic Mail, and that gets to be popular. There's just an enormous number of applications there. And then there's so many things we haven't yet thought about. So, just everything you look at is still applications there.
Following on from that, do you see yourself moving into what is known as the office of the future with all the various applications?
The question is, do we see ourselves going into the office of the future? The answer is probably yes, but I don't like the words. The office of the future, the industry 10 years ago, 15 years ago, was talking about management information systems, where all the information was one big memory, and the executive would sit back and type anything, any question at all, and I'll process for him. Well, it didn't work because you couldn't get that much information, and second, he didn't care. The office automation or office of the future, most of us like to have a non-automated environment. We like all that automation to come, not quite, we like to maintain a relationship with people. And the computer should help that relationship, not be the relationship. So the words I have a little problem with, but it, yes is the answer. Now, I'm going to a conference, a digital conference today, be there for 3 days, and there will be a electronic mail terminal there. So anytime during that conference I want to get my mail, I will go up there, type in last my name, I'll give my name, last my code, I'll give my code, and type out all my mail. All the mail internally it will send me an electronic mail. Now, indeed that's not quite like having a secretary bring it in, but I'll be a long way from my office, and that's just a good way to do it. If I want to, the terminal I have at home, I can do the same thing at home. So far, I haven't wanted to do it at home. I'll carry a briefcase home, but when I'm home, I don't want to see what they're asking. So some of the things, yes, most of them like to have approaches gradually.
How far on that has it gone? I mean, is it purely an alphanumeric output?
Only alphanumeric, yes. It's also a filing system, so that if I'm home and interrogated, my secretary can interrogate, or I can interrogate her letters that were there 3 weeks ago. So it's permanent as a filing system also, and that's what I purposely believe. Well, the most formidable competition, of course, would be IBM. In each of the different businesses we're in, it's a different competitor. And maybe if maybe I should withdraw even the statement about IBM. In most of the businesses we're in, IBM is not the competitor. But they are, overall, the most significant one. What happens to Japan in the future isn't clear. For many years, we've been saying they would be the competition. But it's not quite clear. We don't know yet. They are probably the only government that helps the industry. Everybody else, every other government that tries to help the industry ends up putting it behind. The Japanese may be able to show us Westerners how government can really help. But it's something we have to watch. We do buy semiconductors from them. They do a good job. American semiconductor companies can't fill the demand today, so we go to Japan and buy them, and they do an excellent job. And so, so they're someone to be concerned about. Now, the other question, though, is a marketing question. Marketing Japanese computers here. You know, we have 9,000 field service people. Getting 9,000 field service people takes time. So marketing is another question. But we just watch that. I can't predict that. My theory is that every time government tries to help, it hurts. I'm not so sure about that in Japan. Probably still true. Yes? Just give them freedom and then they go. Good people attract good people. So we can attract the best engineers, and as long as we have that kind of people, we can attract more. We give them good facilities. We don't always have the newest building. In fact, they have the oldest engineering building in the Western world for our main engineering. But we used to say we keep one, every 10th computer, we keep our own use. I think it's still true. Most of those go with engineering. I should figure that one out before I say it clearly, but I think we used all about computers and learning, you know, we did our own engineering. A big part of that is design automation. And we're way behind. We have to wait now too long for design automation. Yes?
You said, I think, that you devoted $120 million to research and development every year. Would that be about the figure I think you said? 8% of million and a half?
Yes, something like, yes.
How much of this will go to software? How much to hardware? On the other hand, how much would you need to maintain your customers happy, the ones who have been buying your equipment and which you're now upgrading, probably, or helping them to upgrade it?
Andy Knowles will speak next. Ask him if I can have that question. I haven't looked lately, this last year, at how much we spent. A little more than half, I believe, of the money we spend goes into software, although it's not broken down clearly. More than half of the people are doing software because they don't use as much money on equipment. So it's roughly half, a little more than they do. As far as the second part, I'm not sure Andy can answer that one.
Could you comment on your vertical integration policy in the future?
Yes. When the demand is high for our products, in the nature of our business, we want to use the capital we have, the people we have, the facilities, and the energy we have in getting more market, which logically leads one to conclusion, buy everything we can buy and only manufacture those things which we can't buy. So we do have our own, we do make some semiconductors. We have a beautiful new building that will be finished the next few months, and it's quite large for making semiconductors. But in general, we say we make no semiconductors. That's just a few specialized, very complex semiconductors. And everything else we buy that we can possibly buy. On the in peripherals, we buy those peripherals which we can buy outside safely. When the numbers get very large that we feel we have to make them, we make them ourselves. And so in general, we don't vertically integrate. We only manufacture when we have to, because we only have limited money, resources, and energy. And we don't believe in vertical integration. Vertical integration is what you do when you have no more ideas.
What's that do to your
knowledge? I think it helps. Because the semiconductor business, there's about 20 or 30 semiconductor manufacturers out there working very hard at very low prices. I don't think the mechanism is the extent of this thing. So in general, I think it helps the markets. Now there are other areas, like when we make a typewriter, much less expensive than anyone else. We make a large one, 50,000 a year, I think. We're, I think, the largest printing terminal manufacturer in the world, I think. And,
it's more than 50,000, and it's upwards of 200,000 in a year or so, just that large.
A year ago, 50, now 200,000. Yeah. We are the world's largest printing terminal manufacturer, and so just volume does that. So there it does pay. It would be wrong to be dependent on someone to
sell out.
What's that?
Do you sell outside?
Oh, we do sell outside, yes. We don't make most of them sell outside. He knows more, so I look at him.
Two-thirds, one-third, something like that.
Two-thirds outside?
Yeah.
What's your attitude to what's growth plan?
It's the same as vertical integration. We, the real limitation on our growth is our ambition fanatic so much. And managing somebody else's problem, we have our ambition for it. So in general, it's no. Now, not theoretical, it's not a moral issue. If there's somebody we needed, Oh, we took IBM's core manufacturing, RCA's core manufacturing facility. We took what facility, which was almost the same as ours, we needed it. We bought that. So where we need something, we'll do it. The level of management, we seem to grow at the right level where managing is exciting, interesting, you like to come to work, and it's not an overwhelming job. But taking on some problem organization or getting married to someone you don't know what you're getting into, that might be an American tradition, but it's not for us. We like to understand what we're doing. One more, Ken.
Have you any idea how many of the outstanding stocks I have instituted?
Somebody told me, maybe, I don't know, somebody told me they read in Europe that 70%. So I got that roundabout from Europe. Al knows that anyway. Any more quick one? Yes.
Can I say before you go, I very much appreciate spending your time to talk with
you. Oh, my pleasure.
I'm very thankful.
I'd love to visit with you and hope you have a good trip. Bye.
Thank you very much, Ken. The answer is precisely 70% of our outstanding shares are owned by institutional holders. Andy Knowles is going to address us next.